And now,
the definition.
Hello. In a dramatic escalation of tensions in the Middle East, a US airstrike has killed Iran's most important military commander. General Qasem Soleimani was the commander of the Quds Force of Iran's elite Revolutionary Guards. They are responsible for Iranian foreign military operations and answer directly to the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Well, General Soleimani, who for many was seen as a charismatic national hero at home, was one of several people killed by a US drone strike as he travelled in a convoy near Baghdad's international airport. Iran has declared 3 days of national mourning and promised harsh vengeance. The Pentagon says the operation was carried out at the direction of President Trump. Well, Mr. Trump has not yet directly commented, but he printed this image of the American flag, the stars and stripes, at the top of his Twitter feed. We begin our coverage now with this report by John Donison.
This is all that was left of a convoy of cars carrying Iran's most senior military commander. His killing by the United States will shake the Middle East to the core. Qasem Soleimani was head of the elite Quds Force of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and a hugely influential figure in the region. In a statement, the Pentagon said the airstrike had been carried out at the direction of the president and that the US military had taken decisive defensive action to protect US personnel abroad. The immediate aftermath of the attack, which happened near Baghdad International Airport, was filmed by passers-by. Several other people with military ties to Iran were also killed. It comes in a week where simmering tensions between Iran and the US have boiled over. The American embassy in Baghdad has been under siege as pro-Iranian militiamen and demonstrators tried to breach its walls, angry at US airstrikes in the region. And yesterday, the US Defense Secretary hinted America might take further action against Iran.
I think it's important at this point in time to not make this a United States versus Iran issue. It's really Iran versus the world. It's Iranian bad behavior that has been going on now for nearly 40 years.
Last night, more than 650 US troops arrived in neighboring Kuwait to provide reinforcements. All eyes will be on Iran's response. In a region already riven with conflict, some will fear this could mean another war in the Middle East. John Donison, BBC News.
The US airstrike came in the middle of the night. Later, the Pentagon tweeted, "This strike was aimed at deterring future Iranian attack plans." Donald Trump, usually very active on Twitter, tweeted only this image. Iranian state TV confirmed the death of General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's top security body called an urgent meeting for Friday. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif tweeted, "The U.S. act of international terrorism targeting and assassinating General Soleimani is extremely dangerous and a foolish escalation." The U.S. government has accused Soleimani of having a key role in fighting in Syria and Iraq. He reported directly to the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. The airstrike also killed the deputy commander of the Iranian-backed militias, known as the Popular Mobilization Forces. The U.S. has accused the group of being behind the recent attack on the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. Experts say the death of Soleimani could be a turning point in the Middle East and potentially draw retaliation from Iran and the forces it backs in the region against Israel and U.S. interests.
And finally, Trita, because I know you have to leave, this is such a significant day today here in the United States, in Iraq and all over the world. If you could explain, who is Soleimani?
So Soleimani is head of the Quds Force, which is the external arm of the IRGC. IRGC itself has a tremendous amount of problems inside of Iran because we've seen how they have been involved in the repression of the Iranian people. We've seen that just in the last couple of weeks. But Soleimani was head of its external activities. And as a result, he was he had an image that was separate from that of the IRGC. Polls made by U.S. entities have shown that he had popularity levels around 70% inside of Iran, which is largely because a large part of that population viewed him as a key reason as to why ISIS was defeated, a key reason as to why that type of radicalism and terrorism did not reach Iran. So this is not going to be something, I think, that will hurt the regime. On the contrary, I think they will utilize this in order to be able to consolidate their power and, on top of that, move the Iranian government in a much more repressive as well as hawkish direction than it was before.
And finally, of course, the U.S. is calling him a terrorist, Iran a hero. Talk about Soleimani's significance around the world and the fact that both Obama, who you've written extensively about, and George W. Bush, though they too had the opportunity, did not assassinate him.
Because they recognize that that would be such a major escalation that it likely would lead to war. It doesn't mean that they in any way, shape or form had a positive view of Soleimani. But they did recognize, I think, that he is revered in corners in the Middle East that may be outside of the control of Iran. And as a result, even if the Trump administration and the government of Iran would end up in a scenario in which both of them would like to de-escalate the situation, they may not be able to do so because they may not be able to control other entities that will seek to take revenge for Soleimani's assassination by killing Americans. And as a result, their ability to put out this fire may be much, much more limited. I think the Bush administration and Obama administration recognize this and, as a result, chose not to go in this direction because they recognize how uncontrollable the situation would be.
Donald Trump, it looks to me like he may have started World War III. And I say that with no glee whatsoever and considerable concern. You know, fill up your gas tank. This is extraordinarily dangerous. Iran is the seventh largest supplier of oil in the world. It is the eighth, they have the eighth largest official army in the world. And then they have paramilitary forces both in Iran and around Iran, in Syria and in Lebanon. You add those together, it may well be that Iran has the fourth or fifth largest military in the world. This is a major country. Iran is several times the size of Iraq geographically and I believe larger than most European countries in terms of population. And Donald Trump has just gone off the rails here. And I'm of the opinion, and, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong on this, but it makes perfect sense to me that Donald Trump is doing right now what he back in 2011 and 2012 was predicting that Barack Obama would do. On November 14th of 2011, Trump tweeted, "Barack Obama," yeah, keep in mind, this was just before November 2011 was the year before 2012, which was the year that Barack Obama was up for re-election. So in November, 1 year before the election, Trump tweets, "Barack Obama will attack Iran in the not too distant future because it'll help him win the election." And then the following year, 2012, now the election year, Obama's up for re-election. He ran against Mitt Romney, as I recall. Here you've got, this is January of 2012, the election year, Trump tweeting, "Barack Obama will attack in order to get reelected." And then in July 3rd, 2012, the day before the 4th of July, again, the election year, Donald Trump tweets, "Just as I predicted, Barack Obama is preparing a possible attack on Iran right before November." And then in August, the next month, August 16th, 2012, Donald Trump tweets, "I always said Barack Obama will attack Iran in some form prior to the election." And then on October 9th, 2012, Donald Trump tweets, "Now that Obama's poll numbers are in a tailspin, watch for him to launch a strike in Libya or Iran. He is desperate." So clearly this is how this man thinks. He has been telling us this since 2011.
Despite all of Trump's talk about wanting to extricate our troops from stupid wars, his policies are sucking us deeper and deeper into a quagmire in Iraq and Syria. Meanwhile, because Trump ripped up the nuclear agreement, Iran is getting closer to developing nuclear weapons capacity. We need to get American forces out of Iraq and Syria now. Trump's policies are short-sighted, and there's no end goal or strategy. There's no clear purpose for our troops to remain in Iraq or Syria. The original purpose of our troops being there was to prevent the resurgence of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, but now our efforts are primarily directed against Iranian, Syrian, and Russian forces, which will strengthen the position of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. In short, American troops are going to be stuck in the middle of a chaotic, multidimensional quagmire, vulnerable to attacks and fighting with Iranian and Al-Qaeda and ISIS forces, who will simultaneously be fighting with Iranian and American forces. It's a mess now, but it's going to be a much bigger and bloodier mess if Trump doesn't get our forces out of that region now. American forces will eventually come home, just like American forces eventually left Vietnam. The only question is, how many more American lives, how many more trillions of dollars will be wasted before we exit? It could be now, or it could be 10 or 20 years from now, but there's no American victory. No one even knows what American victory looks like, so how can we develop strategies to work towards it? Trump's policies in the region have been a disaster for our country and for the world.
We are going to Ro Khanna, who is the Democratic Congress member from Silicon Valley in California, member of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform. Your response, as you join us by telephone, to what has just taken place, Congressmember Khanna.
This is what many of us feared. As you know, I had an amendment in the National Defense Authorization that would have prevented Iran from having any offensive attack against Iran and any funding for that attack. That amendment was stripped from the final bill at the Pentagon's insistence. My belief is that the Pentagon has had this kind of activity in the works and planned for a while, and they have not come to Congress. But the tragedy is that Congress has not insisted on having that authorization.
Well, explain. Explain what has just happened. You, along with Senator Bernie Sanders, fiercely condemned the bipartisan passage of the Pentagon spending bill, the overall spending bill. Why do you believe this allowed for the assassination?
There was an amendment in that bipartisan bill that had passed the House of Representatives that would have prevented the Congress from authorizing any funding for an offensive strike against Iran, including any Iranian officials. The clear language was saying that the president, the Pentagon, had to come to Congress before taking any offensive action. This is clearly an offensive action. It may be an action of retaliation, but it's an offensive action. It's not an action of self-defense where there was imminent harm. And this is exactly what the amendment would have prohibited. That is why the Pentagon pushed back incredibly hard on keeping that amendment in the National Defense Authorization. The White House pushed back incredibly hard, and the amendment was removed, even though the House had passed it and even though a majority of senators had supported it. The amendment didn't make it into the final bill. And I believe that was a signal to the Pentagon that Congress wasn't going to stand up against this kind of action in Iran.
This is from September 2015, Hugh Hewitt and a candidate, Donald Trump. And there is something here that I think kind of distills everything.
If this is what I think it's going to be, it's remarkable.
It's remarkable. We're going to play a little bit of this.
Are you familiar with General Soleimani? Yes. Go ahead. Give me a little. Go ahead. Tell me.
He runs the Quds forces.
Yes. Okay. Right.
Do you expect his behavior?
I think the Quds, by the way, have been horribly mistreated by us.
No, not the Kurds. The Quds forces, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, Quds forces, the bad guys.
Right.
Do you expect his behavior to change as a result?
Kurds.
No.
Sorry. I thought you said Kurds. Because I think the Kurds have been very poorly treated by us here. Go ahead.
Agreed. So Soleimani runs the Quds forces. Do you expect his behavior is going to change as a result of this deal with Iran?
I think that Iran right now is in the driver's seat to do whatever they want to do. I think what's happening with Iran is, I think it's one of the, and I covered it very well, I assume you saw the news conference. I think Iran is, it's one of the great deals ever made for them. I think it's one of the most incompetent contracts I've ever seen. I'm not just talking about defense. I'm not talking about a contract with another country. I've never seen more of a one-sided deal, I think, in my life. Absolutely.
Well, Soleimani is to terrorism sort of what Trump is to real estate. He's many people would say he's the most dangerous man in the world, and he runs the Quds forces, which is their Navy SEAL. Do you think they're going to stop?
The gentleman that was going back and forth with Russia and meeting with Putin, I read something, and that seems to be also where he's at. He's going back and forth, meeting with other countries, et cetera, et cetera.
That's the guy. And
not
so,
good.
Do you think
not good for us? And what it shows is a total lack of respect. I mean, that the other countries would even be entertaining him, and they're entertaining him big league.
So when you went before the Senate,
I just want to say, Derek, what?
That's like that was like a vaudeville routine, really. I mean,
why don't you tell me? Okay. Yes.
I think you don't know who the Quds Force is. You tell me who they are.
And of course, we don't even gloss over the fact that, of course, this bloated scumbag totally betrayed the Kurds.
You're watching Fox and Friends.
Good morning. I'm Steve Big Papa Ducey. That's Ainsley Earhart and Brian Kilmeade.
Howdy.
Hello. We want to say a big hello to all our fans out there, whether you're fixing your breakfast or getting dressed for work or laying in the Lincoln bedroom tweeting with an Egg McMuffin on your chest. Hello!
Yes, you.
Hello. Yes, indeed. Now, coming up,
let's go out to the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, kind enough to be joining us live at this very important moment in American military and security history. Mr. Secretary, thanks so much for joining us. Can you bring us back to that decision when you realized you would have a shot at General Soleimani and you wanted to take that shot?
Well, Brian, good morning.
Good morning.
President Trump made the decision, a serious decision, which was necessary. There was an imminent attack. The orchestrator, the primary motivator for the attack was Qasem Soleimani, attempt to disrupt that plot. You all have been talking this morning about the history of who Qasem Soleimani is. He's got hundreds of American lives, blood on his hands. But what was sitting before us was his travels throughout the region and his efforts to make a significant strike against Americans. There would have been many Muslims killed as well, Iraqis, people in other countries as well. It was a strike that was aimed at both disrupting that plot, deterring further aggression. We hope setting the conditions for de-escalation as well.
All right. The Pentagon did release a statement that one of the reasons that he was taken out now was because he was planning more attacks on Americans. What can you tell us about that generally?
Steve, I can't say much more, but you need not look any further back than just the last few months. Dozens and dozens of attacks against American and allied interests throughout the region by Iran and its proxies, culminating in what happened with an American killed on December 27th. But we've had artillery rounds fired in the direction of Americans to Iraqi facilities. There have been a series of actions, and we've watched that escalation take place. There was an American UAV shot down. The restraint that President Trump had shown was important, and it's now the time we needed to take action to restore deterrence. So the men and women who are on the ground there today, we take seriously the need for their security. We're working on it. We've been planning for this, and we're prepared.
Meanwhile, a whole bunch of really bad news for Donald Trump has happened in the last 24 hours, most of which is absolutely not making it up through the noise of, oh my God, what's going to happen in Iran? And it may well be that these things it may be that this attack happened because of these things coming out. For example, the memos between members of people in the White House and the Office of Management and Budget were leaked yesterday to a website, Just Security, that can absolutely confirm that everybody in OMB or everybody at the senior level, what Mick Mulvaney said was right. Yes, we withheld aid from Ukraine because we wanted them to investigate Joe Biden. And now it's here in black and white. The smoking gun, or another smoking gun, that should lead to his impeachment, number one. Number two, Congressman Ted Lieu and Congresswoman Kathleen Rice of California and New York, respectively, have opened an investigation into Donald Trump or some of the people around him and his family members openly manipulating futures on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Number three, and this is probably the big one, this is probably the one that Trump really doesn't want us to pay attention to. Mark Sumner summarizes it over at Daily Kos with a headline that just kind of summarizes the whole thing. Explosive report indicates that Donald Trump's loans from Deutsche Bank were backed by Russia. And along the way, he was socked with a massive fine for money laundering at his now bankrupt again casino. I mean, he was totally radioactive. No bank in America would loan him money, and he was broke. And Deutsche Bank loaned him $2 billion. And to this day, nobody knows why. Well, now, this explosive report comes out. It's a whistleblower saying that, in fact, Trump's loans from Deutsche Bank were underwritten by a Russian state-owned bank, VTB Bank.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. As president, my highest and most solemn duty is the defense of our nation and its citizens. Last night, at my direction, the United States military successfully executed a flawless precision strike that killed the number one terrorist anywhere in the world, Qasem Soleimani. Soleimani was plotting imminent and sinister attacks on American diplomats and military personnel, but we caught him in the act and terminated him. Under my leadership, America's policy is unambiguous to terrorists who harm or intend to harm any American. We will find you. We will eliminate you. We will always protect our diplomats, service members, all Americans, and our allies. For years, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and its ruthless Quds Force under Soleimani's leadership has targeted, injured, and murdered hundreds of American civilians and servicemen. The recent attacks on U.S. targets in Iraq, including rocket strikes that killed an American and injured four American servicemen very badly, as well as a violent assault on our embassy in Baghdad, were carried out at the direction of Soleimani. Soleimani made the death of innocent people his sick passion, contributing to terrorist plots as far away as New Delhi and London. Today we remember and honor the victims of Soleimani's many atrocities, and we take comfort in knowing that his reign of terror is over. Soleimani has been perpetrating acts of terror to destabilize the Middle East for the last 20 years. What the United States did yesterday should have been done long ago. A lot of lives would have been saved. Just recently, Soleimani led the brutal repression of protesters in Iran, where more than 1,000 innocent civilians were tortured and killed by their own government. We took action last night to stop a war. We did not take action to start a war. I have deep respect for the Iranian people. They are a remarkable people with an incredible heritage and unlimited potential. We do not seek regime change. However, the Iranian regime's aggression in the region, including the use of proxy fighters to destabilize its neighbors, must end, and it must end now. The future belongs to the people of Iran, those who seek peaceful coexistence and cooperation, not the terrorist warlords who plunder their nation to finance bloodshed abroad. The United States has the best military by far anywhere in the world. We have the best intelligence in the world. If Americans anywhere are threatened, we have all of those targets already fully identified, and I am ready and prepared to take whatever action is necessary. And that in particular refers to Iran. Under my leadership, we have destroyed the ISIS territorial caliphate. And recently, American Special Operations Forces killed the terrorist leader known as al-Baghdadi. The world is a safer place without these monsters. America will always pursue the interests of good people, great souls, while seeking peace, harmony, and friendship with all of the nations of the world. Thank you. God bless you. God bless our great military, and God bless the United States of America. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Today, after 2 years of negotiations, the United States, together with our international partners, has achieved something that decades of animosity has not: a comprehensive, long-term deal with Iran that will prevent it from obtaining a nuclear weapon. This deal demonstrates that American diplomacy can bring about real and meaningful change, change that makes our country and the world safer and more secure. This deal is also in line with a tradition of American leadership. It's now more than 50 years since President Kennedy stood before the American people and said, "Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate." He was speaking then about the need for discussions between the United States and the Soviet Union, which led to efforts to restrict the spread of nuclear weapons. In those days, the risk was a catastrophic nuclear war between two superpowers. In our time, the risk is that nuclear weapons will spread to more and more countries, particularly in the Middle East, the most volatile region in our world. Today, because America negotiated from a position of strength and principle, we have stopped the spread of nuclear weapons in this region. The deal has the full backing of the international community. Congress will now have an opportunity to review the details, and my administration stands ready to provide extensive briefings on how this will move forward. As the American people and Congress review the deal, it will be important to consider the alternative. Consider what happens in a world without this deal. Without this deal, there is no scenario where the world joins us in sanctioning Iran until it completely dismantles its nuclear program. Nothing we know about the Iranian government suggests that it would simply capitulate under that kind of pressure, and the world would not support an effort to permanently sanction Iran into submission. We put sanctions in place to get a diplomatic resolution, and that is what we have done. Without this deal, there would be no agreed-upon limitations for the Iranian nuclear program. Iran could produce, operate, and test more and more centrifuges. Iran could fuel a reactor capable of producing plutonium for a bomb, and we would not have any of the inspections that allow us to detect a covert nuclear weapons program. In other words, No deal means no lasting constraints on Iran's nuclear program. Such a scenario would make it more likely that other countries in the region would feel compelled to pursue their own nuclear programs, threatening a nuclear arms race in the most volatile region of the world. It would also present the United States with fewer and less effective options to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. I have been president and commander-in-chief for over 6 years now. Time and again, I have faced decisions about whether or not to use military force. It's the gravest decision that any president has to make. Many times, in multiple countries, I have decided to use force. And I will never hesitate to do so when it is in our national security interest. I strongly believe that our national security interest now depends upon preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, which means that without a diplomatic resolution, either I or a future U.S. president would face a decision about whether or not to allow Iran to obtain a nuclear weapon or whether to use our military to stop it. Put simply, no deal means a greater chance of more war in the Middle East. Moreover, we give nothing up by testing whether or not this problem can be solved peacefully. If, in a worst-case scenario, Iran violates the deal, the same options that are available to me today will be available to any U.S. president in the future. And I have no doubt that 10 or 15 years from now, the person who holds this office will be in a far stronger position, with Iran further away from a weapon, and with the inspections and transparency that allow us to monitor the Iranian program. For this reason, I believe it would be irresponsible to walk away from this deal.
In 2015, the previous administration joined with other nations in a deal regarding Iran's nuclear program. This agreement was known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. In theory, the so-called Iran deal was supposed to protect the United States and our allies from the lunacy of an Iranian nuclear bomb, a weapon that will only endanger the survival of the Iranian regime. A constructive deal could easily have been struck at the time, but it wasn't. At the heart of the Iran deal was a giant fiction that a murderous regime desired only a peaceful nuclear energy program. Today, we have definitive proof that this Iranian promise was a lie. Last week, Israel published intelligence documents, long concealed by Iran, conclusively showing the Iranian regime and its history of pursuing nuclear weapons. In the years since the deal was reached, Iran's military budget has grown by almost 40%, while its economy is doing very badly. After the sanctions were lifted, the dictatorship used its new funds to build nuclear-capable missiles, support terrorism, and cause havoc throughout the Middle East and beyond. Finally, the deal does nothing to constrain Iran's destabilizing activities, including its support for terrorism. In light of these glaring flaws, I announced last October that the Iran deal must either be renegotiated or terminated. 3 months later, on January 12th, I repeated these conditions. I made clear that if the deal could not be fixed, the United States would no longer be a party to the agreement. Over the past few months, we have engaged extensively with our allies and partners around the world. We have also consulted with our friends from across the Middle East. We are unified in our understanding of the threat and in our conviction that Iran has never acquired a nuclear weapon. After these consultations, it is clear to me that we cannot prevent an Iranian nuclear bomb under the decaying and rotten structure of the current agreement. The Iran deal is defective at its core. If we do nothing, we know exactly what will happen. Therefore, I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. In a few moments, I will sign a presidential memorandum to begin reinstating U.S. nuclear sanctions on the Iranian regime. We will be instituting the highest level of economic sanction. Any nation that helps Iran in its quest for nuclear weapons could also be strongly sanctioned by the United States. Today's action sends a critical message. The United States no longer makes empty threats. When I make promises, I keep them.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, it's your brother Larry Mendez. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast introduction. The podcast that you're about to hear, I recorded late after watching and reading, well, watching various YouTube commentaries on the targeted assassination of the Iranian leader, and reading some articles, kind of giving more depth and detail to it. This is a difficult episode to produce, and this introduction is a bit more difficult because now I'm going to wake everybody up to something that has been slowly amassing internationally, but something that has been explained hyperly in the black community, in some areas of the black community. Talking to friends who have traveled overseas, particularly friends who have traveled overseas pre-Obama, post-Bush second term beginning. So this was 2005, 2006, 2007. One point that these people who had went overseas, mostly Europe, some Africa, some the Middle East via the military. One point that had become very, very clear if you traveled outside of the country was how absolutely isolated the United States had become. People, regular people, and by regular people, I'm not talking, impoverished. I'm talking, if you're going to travel across to other countries, you typically don't see really, really impoverished people. You see middle class people, upper class people. But in this realm, people were starting to speak of the United States as untrustworthy, as losing its grip on reality, of being incapable of fulfilling various central ideas to its own international legal structure. It was bad, a friend of mine reported, when he went to Europe for a year. People were really, really viewing the United States as a danger to stability in the Middle East. Now, to understand this, you have to keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, we talk about the Middle East in the United States as if it's a part of another continent, wholly separated from Europe and Asia and Africa. Now, to us in the United States, that is true. The Middle East is another continent, literally another continent. But what happens in the Middle East isn't isolated. It impacts Europe and Asia and Africa. That's a reality. That's a stark, strong reality. And in fact, a lot of the rise of neo-nationalist or just nationalist groups in Europe can be traced to the destabilization of the Middle East by the United States earlier on in this century. Thus, what we were doing in Iraq, and thus the surrounding countries, had massive, massive impact on the amount of immigrants hurrying into Europe. The same is true with North Africa. Because of this, the Europeans started looking at the United States very differently. Very differently. Barack Obama was able to repair that, and I mean that. People, the right wing could not understand why in 2000, and I think it was 2008, when Obama went across the world, when he went to Europe, and he was speaking to, if memory serves me correctly, he was speaking to crowds of like 25,000 people, 50,000 people. I remember seeing some of those photographs and it was unreal. A sea of white folks just going nuts for Obama. The right wing couldn't understand that. Oh, he's just a cult of personality, they would say. He's just a cult of personality, they would say. No. No. Obama was intelligent. And, you know, whatever you want to say about Barack Obama, you cannot say Barack Obama was not intelligent. And considering how hard you have to work as a black person to climb in this society, yes, you either have to be as brain-addled as Carson, who I'm still confident they lobotomized, because he was a brilliant student. Or you have to be sharp, like Obama. And he was intelligent. And he understood the levels of democracy, or excuse me, not democracy, diplomacy. And people could sense that. And they were so tired of these, I hate to say it, these white guys lying, that they were willing to take a chance on a black guy with a funny name And I think even he mentioned that. Just how desperate for change people were. He was able to salvage that. He was able to salvage that. Even in the American public's minds, he was able to salvage that. But the right wing could never wrap their heads around it. Ever. And then Donald Trump was elected. Now, people already knew that Donald Trump was going to go back dramatically on everything Barack Obama had done. Why? Because they had witnessed the same thing with Bill Clinton. Again, as horrible of things that Bill Clinton did, some not good things. He did. But Bill Clinton did a number of positive things too. He did a great number of positive things. And I'm not talking small things. He was stable when it came to diplomacy. Whereas immediately after him came Bush. Jimmy Carter, again, people failed to really look at his record because Jimmy Carter didn't do everything good. Jimmy Carter made some blunders. But Jimmy Carter was stable with his diplomacy. Ronald Reagan was a little less stable, but he was stable. George H.W. was stable, decently so. Well, there's a couple of things, but he was a little bit less stable compared to Clinton. George W. was incredibly unstable with his diplomacy. People give him a pass because of 9/11, but that actually was a symptom of his instability, if we all remember. Obama changed that. Donald Trump reversed that. And as unstable as Bush was with his diplomacy, Donald Trump is far worse. Far worse. And so, because of this, now, there's a little reactionary politics going on here. There's a little reactionary politics going on here. Because of this, now that's why Bernie Sanders is rising. Bernie Sanders is stable. But Bernie Sanders, just like Barack Obama, is an extreme reaction to what the GOP has done. Because the GOP refuses to, and I hate to really use this as a setup for Iran, but the GOP really refuses to do things that are functionally beneficial to not only the domestic realities of this country, but also for the international realities of this country. There is, in their actions, a nihilism as definitively wrought. Not the philosophical. I don't care about the philosophical. You look up the word nihilism or the word nihilist, and that's the definition that I want you to remember. There's a destructive quality to what they're doing. Now, the world is starting to see how unstable the United States political system is. The world is starting to see how unstable the United States political system is. I mean, there is instability going back quite a ways. FDR brought some stability to the United States. And then Eisenhower to Kennedy carried that. With the assassination, obviously, LBJ attempted to facilitate that or to continue that kind of stability. But it was impossible thanks to the wonderful military-industrial complex, which wanted Vietnam. What then are we to draw from this? Because Nixon was massively unstable. Massively unstable. But he was more stable than Donald Trump. just as I said before, you replace the unstable Nixon and Ford with Carter, who was more stable. Reagan was not as stable. Now, what does this all mean? From an international standpoint, the diplomacy is everywhere. Everywhere. But from the domestic standpoint, to white folks, the domestic agenda seemed pretty solid. But to black people, it was not. There's a saying that some of you may not have ever heard, that black America lives in internal colonies. We are colonial subjects to this country. And when we look at our interaction with society and its representatives from the government, there is massive instability. Massive instability. We can go back to World War II and go forward. The things that we were promised in integration fell apart rapidly. White society benefited dramatically from integration. Our communities did not. We had small pockets which grew up, but for the most part, the black community lost its self-sufficiency. It lost its various institutions. It lost incredible, incredible cultural prowess, which helped us create a cultural juggernaut that enlivened us and then strengthened us, that allowed us to carry through the nonsense of the white community. We lost all of that resiliency, all to play fiddle to the white community. Now, many of you may not like that. Frankly, I don't care. That's what happened. When we engaged in integration practices with white society, we were told that it was a two-way street, that we would gain as much as we gave. It didn't happen that way. We gave our culture. We gave our productivity. We gave our genius. And many of you do not understand what that is when I say we gave our genius and how much we have actually contributed to those things which you like, which you love. There is a black man who, if it wasn't for his wonderful mathematics, you would not be using your internet right now. There's many things that I just ain't going to get into. But we were told that. We were told that to integrate into the white community was to be a partner with it, to gain as much as we gave. By the time Dr. King was walking into his assassination, he had even realized that this was a falsehood. Before that fateful year, 1968, in 1966, he had said as much in a speech where he openly said that integration is supposed to be about the transference of ideas, of information. It's supposed to be in equal footing, and it just wasn't. When we begin to say, the heck with this, we need our own still. We just don't need to be, you know, providing fodder for you and providing, you know, fun for you and having to always be the backups to you. Then we were dangerous radicals and dangerous terrorists, and we needed to be handled. To quell that feeling of independence, our community was swarmed with drugs. And the black community back then, and to an extent, even up to today, realizes that that had nothing to do with us. And it worsened. It worsened. Our leaders were put in prison or killed, assassinated, exiled. And more drugs came. That was crack. The poison which sunk into our communities devastated it. Sort of like opioids today, but back then we were thugs and dangerous people, and we had to be put in prison and dealt with harshly. You know, you had to be tough on crime. Today, you gotta coddle these people. And it got worse as academics, black tough academics who had been integrated into the system in the 60s and the 70s, worked throughout the 80s to bring real information to the black community to help us empower ourselves so we can build. In the 90s, they were getting liquidated out of those positions, and more, what's the word I'm looking for? More acceptable Negroes. Of course, white community had graduated. They wouldn't call them Negroes then anymore. But more acceptable people had come into those positions. Those who weren't all about black power, black empowerment, things like that. So why am I telling you this story, right? This has nothing to do with Iran. Oh, but it does. Because when you look at a people as colonial subjects who are not equal to you, you treat them like they're not equal to you. And you don't care what happens to them or their leaders. So yes, this has everything to do with it. Many, many black folks notice. And basically since the 80s, there has been a murmur which has really been in the black community. And I forgot one important adjustment here, because without this, it's not tied together. At the same time with crack cocaine, we also had gangster rap, which glorified the dealing of crack and the violence which was being organized and dispersed in our community. We also had that. And contrary to everyone's wonderful belief, you know, that, well, it was black folks who put this music together. No, no, no. You're smarter than that, and you understand business. Black people were not going about gaining black investors to put this music out. White people were putting white money together and putting these groups together and then putting them out. You had, at the time, a small band of really good hip-hop artists who were being floated and pushed by major white labels. Because black people didn't have major labels. White people had major labels. And those particular groups were not being played on a lot of mainstream radio stations. In fact, just, you know, a little interesting information here. When you had a group like TLC who was completely pop, as much as I liked them, they were pop. They would have songs like What About My Friends, which would be played in its entirety, rap portion and everything, on every white station that could get their hands on it. But when you had a song by them like Waterfalls, they refused, those same white stations that would play Gangsta's Paradise and God, there was other songs that now I'm like blanking out because it was so long ago, but they would play other songs that were more hardcore rap music. Oh, they would play Nate Dogg and Warren G. You know? They would not play Left Eye's rap part. And it wasn't until years later that I realized why not. It was empowering to black people. They would not play songs like 5 o'clock in the morning, but they would play harder songs that put out absolutely negative negative messages. Why? Because that was what was wanted. See, I'm not one of them people who believes that, you know, there's not a conspiracy. I know the white community. I've studied what their politics are. I've studied what their political system is. Yeah, there's a conspiracy. And it's not one person telling another person that they have to do this. There's just set laws and rules and structures that you act upon. You kind of see people thrashing against it today, but for the most part, they're not touching those rules, and they're not touching those structures. Now, during this time period, there was a murmur in the black community. It's the murmur that you are hearing in Europe during the Bush administration. And that murmur was, you cannot trust white people. Their actions, their words are untrustworthy. They mean nothing. They will change their mind whenever they want to, and you need to deal with the consequences when they decide to do that. Now, neoconservatives, these fascists, they know that. They know that this mentality is in black people. They know it. This is why, for the last 40 years, they've been attacking us. And why, with Trump ascending to the White House, they came out with black identity extremists and started coming after our community. Because they know we don't really believe y'all much anymore. Now, some of you may feel hurt about that. Frankly, I don't care. It's not about your emotions. Some of you may feel betrayed by that. Frankly, I don't care. It's not about your emotions. You got to deal with history. And this is the key point. The white community has this mentality about them. We can do whatever we want, whenever we want, however we want, and we will never have to deal with the consequences. The reason why so many progressives are afraid right now, the reason why so many moderate conservatives are afraid right now, is because for the first time, and actually it's not really the first time, but over the last decade, I'm just going to use this wonderful time period, for about a decade, something's been happening throughout this world, in this country, and internationally. The actions that white America has taken haven't just been swept under the rug, as it was in the 80s, as it was in the 90s. No. Mm-mm. There are real consequences rising to what you all are doing. That's why you're all afraid. Now, to give you a great example of this, which has nothing to do with Iran, but will touch a lot of my progressive friends, when Baltimore erupted in 2015, something very interesting happened among a lot of progressives. A lot of progressives. A lot of progressives said the right things on air. They said the right things when they were YouTubing and when they were podcasting and when they were speaking, you know, into the microphones. But then there was Netroots Nation. And there was an interruption by Black Lives Matter, if I remember the group correctly. And you had progressives sounding like hardcore neoconservatives. They don't, even you, don't like the consequences of actions and inaction. The one refrain that I keep hearing from people on YouTube and from the articles that I've read is that Iran's going to have to respond. They're going to have to respond. They're going to have to respond. They're going to have to respond. Yes, actions have consequences. And the terrible thing about consequences is pressure builds up with them. Pressure builds up with them. When you do things to people continuously and you suppress them, because everyone likes to use phraseology today. They like to use words. Oppression. Everybody's oppressed. No. Mm-mm. Everybody is not oppressed. The white Anglo-European community is not oppressed. They are typically the oppressors. In fact, they are just about always the oppressors. And the world knows this. The world knows this. For brief glints in history, that somewhat changed. The 60s, there was hope that that was going to change. Two bullets to JFK's head stopped that pretty much in its track. People had hope even with Bill Clinton. Then Bill Clinton didn't do what everyone wanted him to do, and he got impeached. People had a lot of hope with Obama. But just like generations before, none of us really took into account the deep state. The real deep state, by the way, not the fake one. And now here we are. And now here we are. The consequences wrought from decades of destruction and suppression and annihilation campaigns and putting one group against another. And we're standing at the corner of a hole and wondering if this is the abyss. Is someone just going to come through and knock us down that hole? Do any of you really remember why Osama bin Laden said that he was going to attack the United States? He was hoping to destabilize the U.S. He was. See, there was an older gentleman who passed away some years back named Chalmers Johnson. It's kind of sad that he died when he did, because he was working on another book. He had written three of them, and I believe he was working on a fourth one. Either that or it had come out, and he was working on another book, but he was working on another book. And if I remember him mentioning it correctly, it had something to do with scaling back the military. It had something to do with taking that power out of the military-industrial complex. But he talked about how one of his books' title was Blowback. It's dry, but it's important if you want to really understand the international view of the United States. He talked about how Osama bin Laden was a product of blowback, that the U.S. used him, abused him, and just, you know, threw him away. And he took everything that they taught him and turned it against him. And turned it against him. This is where we're at, ladies and gentlemen. Blowback. The imperialist United States of America, which, you know, let me just, I'll touch on that in a minute. The imperialist United States of America is afraid because its endeavors have sparked so much hatred and discontent and dedication to its destruction that it doesn't know what to do. It has no clue what to do. And by the way, mostly I'm talking about its citizens. Now, I mentioned imperialists, the United States. This is something that I've actually wanted to talk to you guys about for quite some time, and I just kept not working it in to the show. We have to understand, the United States is an imperialist country. Now, obviously you're going to say, well, it has territory, so it is imperialist. That's not what I'm speaking about here, guys. I'm speaking about something far more telling. Something that I really believe has just been overlooked by the white community. There has been black authors who have written about this. And I'd probably say if we went back to the 60s, there were white authors writing about this, because back then, you know, you still had a lot of deeply radical white folks who were telling the truth. But today, we forget about this. What am I talking about? When we think about the United States military presence across the world, we think of it in a predominant way. We say that the United States has military bases across the world because it feeds corporations and because of our military-industrial complex. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's not why the United States has as many bases across the world as it does. Obviously, we know some of them came from the World War. But there's another reason why the U.S. has all these bases around the world. At the end of World War II, colonialism was known to have collapsed. It was over. It was done. Europe, now I want you to really think about this, because this is a new way of looking at the World War. Europe's hyper-colonialism had led to massive destabilization on its continent, and an internal fight between the powers on the continent who wanted more land but were boxed in and could not have more land. People like Germany, or countries like Germany, who were forced to pay for World War I, seeing their territorial footprint across the world, which was already pretty small, diminished. As did Italy. And they were angry about that. They were angry for many reasons. Basically, Germany and Italy were being financially colonized. Not so much Italy, but definitely Germany. And so they fought back. They fought back hard. And that was the war. And that war caused the colonial aspirations of Europe to flee. Now, in order to rebuild Europe, you needed money and you needed natural extractions. The reason Europe needed colonies in the first place was because Europe has no natural, well, very few natural extractions. In other words, they needed those other colonies. But those colonies knew they were weak and were not hearing anything about colonization anymore. They were done. Do you see where I'm going with this? The only kid on the block that was strong was the United States. And you had many former colonies who weren't against their mother countries or the countries that had conquered them, but were certain that they were not going to be colonial subjects anymore and were ready to do what was necessary, meaning claim their sovereignty by claiming their internal wealth. Remember with Iran, what was it, Mossadegh was assassinated when he nationalized the oil reserves. Well, this was a cultural concept. People are like, oh, socialism this, socialism that. Yeah, socialism is natural, guys. You make into a commonwealth the natural extractions of your community so that it benefits everybody. That's called natural. Capitalism is not natural. So you had all of these colonies saying, to hell with you. We are taking our natural extractions, which you need, and we need, and we are putting it into a common trust. We are, quote, nationalizing them for the benefit of everybody here. Now, these countries weren't in any position to stop them from doing that. But guess who was? That was the United States of America. And so working with British intelligence, French intelligence, you know, the other five eyes, we have the CIA, and then there's five eyes in Europe. Working with them, they went to war with these communities, with these countries, with these colonies, and said, if you do not do what we want, we're going to overthrow your leaders, kill them, and cause war. And they did that. And in the process, they established footprints. Really, cancer colonies in these communities to control them. And the United States became the possessor of the colonial footprints of Europe. They became the possessors of the colonial footprints of Europe. In every single corner of the world, they open, or should I say, every single corner of the colonial world, which was supposedly passing away, they opened up bases, usually bases that had already been there. They just took them over. And they became the managers of that colony. They became the managers of that colony. And they forced those subjects into taking their natural extractions and giving it to the U.S., giving it to Europe, sending all kinds of financial resources. Now, with finances, I always use resources because that's what they are. They're not natural extractions. But all kinds of financial resources back to the former motherlands. And you can still see this today. One of the reasons, and by the way, you can still see this today, France, it has been under tremendous pressure for the last 10 years to let its former colony subjects go. It was forcing Haiti, and still is, I believe, forcing Haiti to pay for its independence. It has been forcing Haiti, even back when Haiti had its earthquake, it was forcing Haiti to pay for its independence. It was forcing $500 billion out of billion francs out of its former colonies in Africa. I mean, this, you know, this is what's been happening. The United States has been the controller of the colonies. This is why when Donald Trump spoke about more of Europe paying for what the United States does, this is why so many European heads of states became disheveled. This is why many people within the United States business class and intelligence class became very upset. Because what Donald Trump was saying was, look, we are providing a colonial service to you guys, and you're not really paying us that much to do it. That's what he was saying. He was telling the American public, we weren't listening, he was telling the American public, and I understand why not, because people are still in the belief that this is a very free and loving and democracy-spreading country. There's a book, and it was by a New York Times journalist called Democracy, America's Most Dangerous Export, I think was the title of it. And, yeah, he goes through and pretty much tells you. I think it was by Seymour Hersh, maybe. He goes through and he tells you, look, the United States, what it means by democracy ain't what you think it means by democracy. The United States of America is the colonialist watchdog. It keeps the Anglo-European order intact across the world, so Europe primarily benefits from the world, its natural extractions, and its economic networking. This is why Europe and America are really joined at the hip. This is also why they are deathly afraid of China, or even the primary reason, oh man, they're afraid of China, they're less afraid of India, but, and this is the secret that most of you don't know, they're afraid of Africa. They're afraid of Africa. And they're afraid of Africa for good reason. Africa has a very young population. I'm talking about the continent, y'all. This young population is very interconnected, very well educated, and very determined to see their home countries do much better. They also have an awareness that previous generations didn't seem to have, that their continent is where it's at. Without their continent, China couldn't do anything it could do. Europe couldn't do anything it could do. The Middle East wouldn't do anything it could do, because all of them need a lot of natural extractions from Africa. This is why the United States has AFRICOM, and it is putting tons of money, financial resources, into Africa. Because it can't afford to lose Africa. Now, to be fair, Donald Trump understood this and started talking very early about developing strong partnerships with Africa that would benefit the United States. Barack Obama, the great neoliberal that he is, absolutely flummoxed that up, but that's another story. We need to understand the blowback, the anger, the hostility. It is all built around. It is all built around this idea that the United States is a colonial presence and is acting on behalf of the Anglo-European colonial order. The Anglo-European colonial order. Now again, to white America, this sounds fanciful. You remember I asked a question some time ago where I said, you know, are you an anti-imperialist or are you an imperialist? You cannot be a capitalist and not be an imperialist. This sounds fanciful to all of you. But to the black community, we know the truth about it. We do. We know America is just a colonial bulldog. It's been one for quite some time. Now, the U.S. doesn't want to tell you that, but it's the truth. Even how it runs the United Nations, which the United Nations, guys, honest to God, wasn't built for any real or as any peace instrument. It wasn't built for that. It was built to maintain the control of the colonial order. It was built to ensure that Anglo-Europeans, both on this continent and in Europe, remained at the helm of the world order. If you look at the quote Security Council, recently they're trying to bring China into the Anglo-European colonialist order, but the Chinese ain't having it. They were also trying to bring Russia into the Anglo-European colonialist order. But Russia seems to be increasingly going its own separate way as it's made its alliance with China. That is what the UN is. That's what the UN is. Now, whatever you can say about them in their beginning and what they were hoping for and things like that, I get that. But as I've said this to people who I've talked to about, you know, the UN and what it's really for, I've said straight up to them, I'm like, look, you can't have an organization start during a period when the organizers view black people, brown people, red people, yellow people, basically anybody who's not white, as less than them, and needing to be guided by Europeans, by whites, or else they would just be living in caves. By the way, that's the non-Europeans would be living in caves. When in fact, it was the Europeans who were living in the caves, but that's another story too. That's how they viewed them. That's how they viewed them. You can't have an organization, a global organization, started during a period where the mass mind of white people believes this. I don't care if you're talking about the street sweeper or the executive or the president or the billionaire. They believed it. They all did. You can't have an organization started without it actually having within its genetic structure that idea. And it had in its structure that idea. That's why you got the Security Council, ladies and gentlemen. It's called the Security Council because it is security for the white Anglo population. It's not a security for the rest of the world. It is a security for them. That's what it does. And because they got a cool black friend on it, doesn't mean that it still doesn't do that. This is why the Security Council has veto power, but the mass of other countries can't veto the Security Council. The world is still a colonist order. And that's why capitalism is being fought. Because the world knows capitalism isn't fair. It is about white supremacy. It is about white dominance. And ultimately, just as the wonderful Dr. Welsing said, it perpetuates white genetic survival. Yeah, that's a bomb that I'm dropping on you at the end of the episode. Because that's something, by the way, that I hear a lot, or I used to. I don't hear it anymore because people are like, that kind of sounds racist. But I used to hear that a lot, that the reason why parents didn't want their children, white parents didn't want their children marrying black or brown, is because they did not want, they didn't want brown babies. That was it. And now they think brown babies are cute because of Barack Obama. But a long while ago, no. They did not want brown babies because they were afraid of losing their whiteness into the black hordes. So, just something to think about, guys. So this is part one. I already have part two recorded. I'm going to post them together. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. Yes, I gave you a lot in this one, but I had to, because it's time that, especially white America, you guys got to wake up. You guys have to see what is happening. You have to see why it's happening, and you have to make decisions to ensure that it doesn't, that this cycle really does break. I've told you before that this next decade is huge. A lot will be riding on it. A lot will be decided on it. And in order to decide correctly, you have to be willing to see truth without illusion. And too many of y'all want to see a blurry truth. A blurry truth. Now, to give you a quick example of this, I'd kind of stopped listening to the Young Turks because as much as I liked them before, they were getting too moderate for me, and their structure for some reason was just, it wasn't in a good spot. It just didn't, I don't even know how to describe it, but they weren't as passionate about what they used to be about, passionate about, and I just couldn't really deal with them. But over the short New Year break, I started listening to them again. And I realized that one of the problems with the Young Turks was that they were trying to have truth with ideology. They were trying to still maintain a connection to this, I don't want to call it a limited worldview, but this progressive worldview that's not really well defined, while seeing some sharp edges of reality and calling those sharp edges out. And that's, you can't do that. As I like to tell some of my white progressive friends and kind of get them off of doing that, is I'm black, I don't get to live in fantasy, and I'm not letting you do it. And to their credit, that was pretty evident, you know, in the clips that I was watching. It was pretty evident that they had started really seeing things a bit more truthfully. And so I'm hoping that continues, because ultimately, in order for the white community, the white society, to really deal with its anxiety and its fear and its tendency to want to overcompensate, which tends to make things worse, they're going to have to see reality as it is. They're going to have to recognize that capitalism is imperialism, is racism, is destructive to the environment, is destructive to family. They're going to have to realize that amongst their ranks, they have a bunch of people who are authoritarians. They're going to have to realize that among their ranks, they have a bunch of people who politically don't care about anything except for being told what to do. And they'll do what's right or they'll do what's wrong. And they're going to have to make some deep, deep, deep choices for the future. They're going to have to define what progressivism is. I told you I may be putting out a list of some principles, some perspective principles over there, you know, sometime later on this year. But they're going to have to make that decision. They're going to have to make a decision on what to do with the world. And in order to make those decisions, they're going to have to see the world as it truthfully is. And the sound of the crowd in my ear. I'm done talking, y'all. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always leave me a message. This is your brother, Vi Merit Deese. Part 2 is coming up. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alone.